Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 213 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the second part of a two-part interview, John Mayhew speaks with John Sadiq about his typical working day, creating a plausible backstory for Jules Verne's Captain Nemo while remaining true to Verne's fictional universe, and making the leap from full-time employment to full-time writing. You can hear the first part of this interview in episode 209.
I've driven over the plains of Cheshire to the expansive countryside of the Wirral to meet John Mayhew, who writes adventure horror stories for children. He also has the amazing but daunting job of reworking Shakespeare's stories to make them accessible to younger readers. An incredibly prolific writer, he's also the author of a book series featuring Prince Dakar, that is, a young Captain Nemo who you may not realise from his filmic depictions as an Indian Muslim hero from the time of the First Indian War of Independence. We settle by the wood-burning stove in John's kitchen with his two dogs to talk about his career as a writer and how he came to leave being a secondary school teacher to being a purveyor of fast-paced adventure and scary stuff.
What does your kind of typical writing day look like now? Is it kind of settled into a pattern?
No, I don't have a structure in a sense. Sometimes I'll have a word count. So I will want to achieve, and it's totally arbitrary, really, yeah. But, you know, 2,000 words, 3,000 words today. It's largely dictated about my enthusiasm and how much I know the character. So, yeah, if I kind of wake up and think, oh, I've got this great idea, I must do this, then, you know, I can write up to, I've written up to 10,000 words in a day, you know. But it's, again, it's that first draft, and it's, you know, it's the enthusiasm that's just carrying you along. What I don't do, I have certain rules, really, that I have to stick by just for my own sanity. So if I'm writing, I write first. You know, I'll get up in the morning, I'll have my breakfast, and I write first. That's what I do, because the moment I open an email, the moment I open Facebook, Twitter, any of those things, then my chances of writing anything decent are just gone.
Yeah.
There's a different part of my brain that deals with the business of being a writer, and unfortunately, it's different to the writer's brain that I have. And I think that's probably true of a lot of people, really. Alan Bennett talks about, you know, being a writer and writing, and they're two different.
Yeah, things. And I think a lot of people actually mistake the business of being a writer with being a writer.
Yeah.
And that is really not the same thing. In any way, the turning up is the thing. Henry James says something about writing has to come first, but he didn't have to deal with Facebook,
yeah,
and Instagram and all that sort of thing, and email, but you could imagine him saying something quite profound about Facebook, really.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about your Nemo series.
Mm.
You've taken over the Captain Nemo stories, or rather his kind of early life, Prince Dakar.
Mm.
And I just kind of quite fascinated how that kind of has come to you.
Mm.
You know, how does, you know, such a big character that is universally known, although quite interestingly, I don't think people know that much about him.
No.
He's a much more interesting character than we think he is.
Mm.
How did that kind of come to you?
Well, again, it was kind of tied up with the publishing business as well. I was approached by a publisher to write. This was when Mortlock, the first three Mortlock books were doing very well. They were out there. And this other publisher kind of saw me as a writer who wrote historical stuff for children, mid-grade 8 to 12. And they approached me with another project with a similar footprint. So it was a historical. It was a young character, so it was, but it was a character from history. And at the time, I was tied in to a contract with Bloomsbury, and I had to ask their permission. And so I went to them and talked about it, and they said, well, you know, we really don't want you to do it. Have you got any ideas if you want to write something like that? Have you got any ideas? And I'd always I'd always liked the character of Captain Nemo. He'd cropped up in various media that I consumed as a teenager and as a child, you know, from the James Mason character in the Disney films right through to comic book characters. There are all kinds of depictions of Captain Nemo. And my uncle had bought me 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea to read. I said before, I was a slow reader. And it's not the easiest book to read when you're young. It's full of descriptions of mollusks and all kinds of migrations of porpoises across various parts of the ocean. You know, it isn't necessarily totally a rip-roaring adventure. You have to sort of pick out those bits, rather like Moby Dick in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
You could compress Moby Dick down to you know, a much thinner book. Terrible thing to say.
I was going to say I would edit Shakespeare, but you do.
So maybe I'm just the world's worst Philistine. I don't know. But so I'd encountered Captain Nemo quite a lot in my youth, and he was a character that intrigued me. So when this opportunity came up to write something, there was obviously, again, a market footprint for, you know, there'd been a young James Bond,
yes,
a young Sherlock Holmes,
yeah,
classic character. And I reread 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and the character just fascinated me. There he is, you know, a man who has spent his life under the sea. He hates empires, he hates colonialism, he hates the oppression of the poor. And yet, at the same time, he could sink a whole sailing ship full of poor sailors who he allows to drown.
He was very embittered after the kind of first war of Indian independence, wasn't he?
Exactly, yeah. And this is where kind of Verne kind of falls apart for me, because yeah, his wife and child are killed in the first Indian uprising, and so he goes off to an island and builds a submarine. Like, whoa, hang on a minute. How could he do that? How did he have the knowledge? How did he get the technology to do that? Where did all that come from? And so that took me back to Mysterious Island, where Captain Nemo appears again. And we get a little bit of Atwood's background there. It's not a lot. He says basically from the age of 10, Prince Dakar, who was the son of an Indian Raja, was sent to Europe for an education. And it talks about the various courts that he hung about, and, you know, he adopted various personas as he grew up. So it still didn't help in a way. And I kind of get that, you know, if some oppressive force had killed your family, you'd want to get back at them. But it wouldn't occur to me to go and, like, find a tropical island and build a submarine. Mm. I'd probably take up arms and form a little army and die in the process, probably. But so I kind of thought, you know what? What led him to that? And so this idea of him going to England and Europe and for an education, I thought, well, he'd have to have a mentor. He'd have to have someone that would have taught him these skills, you know, engineering, science, all of these great things. And then it got even more interesting, because as I researched further into Jules Verne, it turns out that actually, when Jules Verne first created the character of Nemo, he wasn't Indian at all. He was a Polish immigrant who had come to England because the Russians had kicked him out of his own country. And it was only when Jules Verne's publishers approached him and said, we really can't make him Polish because we want to sell the book in Russia. What can we do? And Verne said, well, we need to think of someone who's universally hated. I know, we could make him Indian and he gets kicked out by the English. Because everyone hates the English, so that's great, you know. And that's what happened. But it's fascinating. I found an extract of Mysterious Island that was printed in, I can't remember, something like Philadelphia Press or something. So it's an American newspaper, and it was like the 1870s. And it said in it, because in the book that I had, which was the English version, the version that was sold in England, it says from the age of 10 to 30, Prince Dakar went to England for an education so that he might learn the ways of Western people and take them back to his country to civilise them further. Yeah. Nice. The American version was, from the ages of 10 to 30, Prince Dakar went to England for an education so that he may learn the ways of his oppressors and one day overthrow them.
Wow, the difference is quite incredible, huh?
Yeah, it's fascinating. So then there was a whole dynamic about, well, why did Dakar's father send him?
So you seem to have stayed very true to Vern in a way.
Yeah.
You're kind of loyal, and that's very good. That's a lovely thing.
Mm. And yeah, you know, so I've tried to use a Vernian world. So there are dinosaurs at the centre of the earth. There are giant cavemen. There are these huge sea monsters that lurk in the depths.
Mm.
But I've tried to superimpose that over a real historical world. Because, again, I think Vern wanted to do that. The one thing that... and that was kind of editorial. It changed editors halfway through. And one of the things I really wanted to do was to have a look at the attitude of the people at that time would be towards Dakar. And, I have to say that my editors were cautious of it. And then in the last book, I have them foiling a pirate raid on a Cornish village. So there are Algerian pirates stealing Cornish peasants for slavery in the Mediterranean, which again was a big, very interesting issue. Everyone was quite cheerful to take slaves, but take European slaves to Christian slaves to the Mediterranean, that becomes a big issue. And when he rescues them, they are terrified of him, and he starts to question again who he belongs to, who is he fighting for. And those are things that, again, that actual series has ended now. But if I continued that, I can imagine, taking those questions further, really.
And that seems to be a little bit of a theme then through your books, because in Mortlock, there's this thing that's said a few times, like most people, they're good, and there's a bit bad.
Yeah. That is a thing, yeah. I mean, Dakar's certainly thinking, who can he trust? Mortlock. There are, the people you think you can trust turn out to be untrustworthy. And, I wonder whether that's... There's a whole side of my family. My dad grew up in... was born in Hull. And there's a whole side of that family which I've lost touch with. But some of them were quite unusual. And my grandmother was a Victorian. And when I was little, they fascinated and frightened me with the sternness and the strictness and the strange etiquette. And, it wasn't that long ago. That's the strange things, how generation span time is quite strange. But and also I think growing up in the sort of 60s, as a child, you were told, be careful of that person. You were allowed to roam or whatever, but you weighed people up, And I think maybe that's kind of part of that impulse. The other one is that amazing teenage moment when you actually realise that adults aren't that clever and aren't going to save your life ever. which you think is an incredible realisation, that actually looking at someone and think, you're not too bright actually, are you? And, it's quite a revelation, because up to that point, you kind of assume that adults are going to, as I say, run the world and everything's going to be okay. And I think maybe that's what my books deal with a little bit.
Yeah, I think that definitely comes through.
Yeah, it's hitting that realisation that all is not necessarily well. Yeah.
Just kind of going back to sort of being a writer and a teacher at the same time, I just wondered kind of at what point you knew that teaching was over.
And you kind of
moved towards being, that's it, I'm writing now. Yeah.
It was a very slow process, actually. I mean, I was published in 2010, and I didn't actually... Yeah, so it was about 3 or 4 years, so it became clear that I couldn't sustain the two quite early on, but other things were kind of happening as well. I changed jobs and became an advisory teacher for Cheshire in the area of autism, and worked a lot with staff and children and medics and all kinds of people, really. And that was interesting, because although it was full on and it was very busy and you were driving around a lot, I didn't have the same marking load. I had to write reports, but they were in no way as time consuming, in a sense. So that freed me up and gave me time. But then other changes happened within my sort of working life. I went part-time as a teacher. I worked in a school, a primary school actually, for children with autistic spectrum condition. And I did that for a couple of years. And part-time teaching, I just don't think there's such a thing. It just bleeds into everything, you know. And that was the point. I thought, you know, I'm not giving either my full attention. And so I, at that point, decided to take a leap and write full-time. It's that old, you know, do it anyway and weave your safety net is on the way down, isn't it? You know,
I don't think there's another way, is there? There isn't any other way to do it.
I don't think there is. I mean, I am, you know, it's just the generation that I've grown up in, I think, really. But I am very cautious as a person and financially cautious as well. So I did make sure I had a war chest of savings, to be honest. And the deal was that if we dug into half of that war chest, then it wasn't working. Up to now, that hasn't happened. So it's kind of working well. It is a leap because at the end of the day, you know, all of the things that full-time work gives you, or even part-time work, pensions and all the paid holidays, all of those sorts of things, you, as a freelancer, you don't get. You know, but you get other.
There's other stuff to it, isn't there?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And then very final question. Mm. This is kind of quite a personal one, I think. And fiction is such a kind of involving world. And, you know, you've got your characters in your head and you, when you go out running, you know, you've got Captain Nemo and Josie Mortlock kind of in your brain and things. But I often wonder with fiction writers whether there's a kind of a more personal project that you'd like to write that's kind of either tucked away under the mattress that you don't show your publisher or anybody, or something that you would love to kind of one day when you kind of retire from fiction kind of thing, you'll attend that.
I put a lot of myself, I think, into the books anyway. There was a project actually when I started with the Royal Literary Fund about my daughter has epilepsy and developed at the age of 12, and it has affected her in lots of ways. And I really want to write about that. And I did actually write a story called Blink, which is it's a story about epilepsy, and it was wrapped up with Welsh folklore and magic realism. And I took it to my publisher, and they didn't like it. So I don't know. I might self-publish that. I might change it. I don't know. But then I kind of wonder if that's too close to home, and that actually maybe I don't need to write about that because I'm kind of dealing with that in everyday life, and you know. But there's a kernel of an idea that I really want to write about, and maybe that will happen. And that is that a young girl with epilepsy meets a character called King Hurler. King Hurler is a Welsh Borders mythical character who basically went to the King of the Fairies wedding under the hill and had a high old time. And as he left, the King of the Fairies helped him onto his horse and then put a lapdog onto the pommel of the saddle and sent them off. And as they went, he just called after them, "Don't get off the horse until the dog jumps down." And the story is that King Hurler is still walking around on his horse, immortal, because he didn't get off. If he does, he'll turn to ashes. Because 200 years had passed under the fairy hill. Now, my notion was that this girl meets King Hurler and he says, "Ride with me. You know, you will never have another seizure again. You'll never suffer. All you have to do is be my companion." You know, would you make that trade? It's just fascinating, you know. So many parallels between the two.
Yeah, but there's kind of, you know, within literature, you know, one of the things is that kind of, yeah, we have all these wonderful stories and things, but it's still that kind of that personal stuff that kind of comes through. You see yourself reflected in some way, you know.
I think the most important thing is the story.
Yeah.
And then.
That happens anyway, doesn't it? Exactly. Kind of the human stuff happens anyway, as long as you get that bit right.
That's it. Yeah. So I'll keep working on that. You never know.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
That was John Mayhew in conversation with John Siddique. You can find out more about John on his website at www.johnmayhew.co.uk. That's John, spelt J-O-N. And that concludes episode 213, which was recorded by John Siddiq and produced by Conor McPhee. Coming up in episode 214, Eleanor Dimott speaks with Robin Blake about storytelling's essential role in the British legal system, migrating from law journalism to fiction, and the childhood origins of an unsettling recurrent theme in her writing. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.